We'll continue with our second case on our docket this morning, All American Telephone versus USLD Communications. If the clerk will please announce counsel for each case. All right, Mr. Carroll.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is an appeal from a partial summary judgment that was severed from the 67th District Court. There are three causes of action that are dealt with on this appeal. One is malicious prosecution, one is tortious interference, and the third is fraud, and there is an evidentiary issue. This is a culmination of about 10 years of litigation by two men and their company. Who have had their livelihood, their homes, their company, and everything else basically taken away from them and almost lost their freedom. And they are here today asking this court to allow them the opportunity to present those facts to a Tarrant County jury. The factual setting over this 10-year history is set forth in our briefs. I don't have time today, and I'm sure the court doesn't want me to review that factual setting, so I will leave that to the briefs. Let me address first, if I may, Your Honors, the malicious prosecution issue. Mr. Thibodeau and Mr. Noick were indicted on May the 5th of 2002. After some 2 years, they were acquitted here in Tarrant County Federal Court by a jury on November the 12th of 2002. Now, the indictment that they were charged with charged conduct that occurred between 1995 and July or later of 1999. That conduct involved what's called cramming and slamming and various kinds of misdeeds with respect to the sale of long-distance telephone charges or usage. The basis of the indictment was that Thibodeau and Noick controlled AAT, and I will call it, I assure you, AT&T, and I apologize, it's AAT. That's the essence of the indictment, that they controlled that during this time period, and they engaged in this misconduct, and they took money illegally, and that money belonged to USLD, and USLD was victimized by this, and that was the theory on which that case was tried. In April of 2002, an attorney for USLD arranged for one of his employees, a Mr. Torres, whose affidavit is attached to the plaintiff's or to the second amended petition intervention, arranged for him to meet with the government. They also provided the government with a copy of Mr. Torres' affidavit with the second amended petition and intervention, and most importantly, what they didn't supply the government with was this information. At that time, they knew that Mr. Thibodeau and Mr. Nowick were not billing anybody on behalf of AAT because these people had, by an agreement with the servicing agent, taken all of the records, taken the money themselves, and taken control over everything. They had it. So when they gave this information to the federal government, they knew, pursuant to the agreement between them and Hold, that it was absolutely impossible for Mr. Nowick and Mr. Thibodeau to have been in control of the billing of these items and to have been guilty of what they were charged with in the indictment. If you look at Mr. Torres' affidavit, it says that All American is liable to USLD for these outstanding fees. The problem with that is this. Their own witness, Mr. Wagner, testified that at no time was USLD and AT&T seller and customer of each other. And second, he testified that there was no indebtedness owed by All American Telephone to USLD. Rather, the indebtedness was multimedia. The agreement that I referred to between Hold and USLD was never disclosed to the prosecutors. The prosecutors were left with the impression that USLD had been victimized by Mr. Thibodeau and Mr. Nowick, that they had been in control of all of these billings when, in fact, they had not been in control of any of them. And after the agreement between Hold and USLD was entered into, that agreement was never disclosed to the prosecution. We say that that satisfies probable cause, it satisfies malice, and it shows that there is at least a factual issue raised with respect to whether or not these people were guilty of malicious prosecution. Now, the argument in response is, well, we didn't actually request the prosecution, but that doesn't make any difference. They don't have to initiate it, and they don't have to request it. Under the case law that's very clear, set forth in the brief, if they give information to the government that, one, they know is false, or, two, they fail to disclose fully to the government the entire circumstances, then they are responsible for initiating the malicious prosecution. Here, it is absolutely clear that no one could have believed that Thibodeau and Nowick were in control of AAT so that they could engage in this billing conduct during that period of time. So the probable cause is established because Mr. Wagner, their own witness, I believe he was the president of their company, in fact, testified, we never had anything that was owed to us by AT&T, and we didn't have a contract with them. And second, that the agreement that was not disclosed to the prosecution clearly establishes that they were not in control at the time, that in fact USLD was in control of those records. Now, the response to that is, well, okay, maybe we'll accept that as being accurate, but even so, you're barred by limitations. The indictment was presented, as I said earlier, in May. They were acquitted on November the 12th. So 1 year, and we agree, 1 year statute of limitations on malicious prosecution. However, on November the 12th, the question I would pose rhetorically is, who would we have sued? We had been acquitted, and we knew in our hearts we had never been guilty at all of anything. But on November the 12th of 2003, who would we have sued? And the answer is nobody, because until later that year did we know what they had done. Did they finally, even though these agreements were requested in December of 1998, and they existed at the time, not until December, after the statute had run, did they then disclose to us, well, we've been feeding information to the government, and we did not give the government this agreement that would clearly show that you people could not have been guilty of what you're accused of.
Excuse me a minute, Mr. Carroll. Are we okay with the light system? Okay.
Am I through?
No, I think you've got... I think you've got like two more minutes.
All right, Your Honor. Two more minutes. I'm going to leave the other arguments for the treatment in the brief because I thought I was getting away with it a lot longer than I was supposed to.
No, you've got about two more minutes. Okay,
very. Thank you. This is kind of like when they say that, you know, that we should have filed suit earlier. It's kind of disingenuous because we couldn't have filed suit earlier because we didn't know who to sue because we didn't know anything. We knew the prosecution had filed an indictment against us and we'd been acquitted. But we had no reason to know that it was a wrongful prosecution, that it was instituted by someone feeding information to the government that we believe was untrue and was inaccurate. So consequently, the statute of limitations, both either on a fraudulent concealment, because we had asked for the documents and they hadn't given them to us, or on a theory of failure to disclose, they did not give us the information such that we could have known who to sue. And it's not just that you were prosecuted and acquitted. It's that the prosecution was wrongful. And until you can figure out whether it's wrongful or not, there is no way to file suit at that time. So we did file suit, and I don't think anybody questions this, within 1 year of discovering this information.
And tell me again, who was the agreement, the written agreement that you were having difficulty discovering? Who was that contract between?
The agreement, Justice Livingston, was between USLD and a company called Hold.
Which was the factoring company.
Yes, the servicing company. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And all of our call records, all of our billing records, all of the information about what we were owed, all of those things we could not do anything with once Hold agreed to take all those things away from AAT.
And they did that pursuant to their security agreements.
Hold had a security agreement with AAT.
Okay. But usually under most security agreements, wouldn't they have retained an obligation to report what they were doing to AAT?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the thing is that they would have retained an obligation to report to us. We were entitled to the records. It's our position that we were never in default, that at the time, in fact, they owed us about $2 million, not the other way around. And more importantly to this case is USLD has not established as a matter of law that they were that USLD or Hold was owed any money by AAT. There is no final judgment that says that at all. So consequently, that element of proof has not been met. We request, with respect to the malicious prosecution, that be reversed and sent back for trial. There can be no question, and I don't think there is any issue, with respect to the other elements of malicious prosecution raised here. They concede that we were charged, that we were acquitted, that we obviously have been damaged by being falsely accused of a criminal offense. With respect to the other issues, if I can just briefly, we believe that the evidence is clear as to the fraud claim and the tortious interference claim, both, that at least a fact issue has been raised. We're not saying we won, we may lose in the trial court, but we think that there is enough evidence, particularly when the court uses what we're entitled to, we believe, and that is every inference being taken in our favor as to whether fraud was committed, as to whether they interfered with our contracts. The one thing I will say about the contracts and the tortious interference is they say, well, you didn't identify by name your customers. And my response to that is this. They took the records and they denied us access to the bulletin board system, which would have told us the names of those customers. So their position is sort of like the kid who does away with his parents and then asks the court for mercy because he's an orphan. They did this. They did this. We couldn't have given them the specific names. I don't think that's required. I don't think the case is required. But nevertheless, we could not have provided that because of their own conduct. And they cannot, in our view, take advantage of that conduct in order to argue that we did not prove up at least a factual issue with respect to whether we're entitled to have a jury decide tortious interference and also malicious prosecution and fraud. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Mr. Bolt.
Good morning. May it please the court, Robert Bolt for Appellees. This dispute began in 1998 as a shareholder dispute within All American Telephone, and All American Telephone sued its president and fellow shareholder, Clay Gary, and accused him of misappropriating funds, using them for personal reasons, and failing to treat them as corporate funds. USLD, I'm representing Quest and its predecessor, USLD. USLD intervened in that case to collect over $2 million that it was owed for providing long-distance services to All American Telephone. USLD did not. Counsel mentioned, and he may have misspoke, that USLD has not proven that it was entitled to the $2 million. And, of course, USLD obtained a summary judgment in its favor on the $2 million, which is not being appealed. And so what we're here talking about today are the counterclaims. There were nine of them now. We're down to the three that counsel mentioned.
Well, what is the status of that summary judgment?
The summary judgment was entered long ago, and we're in the attorney's fees process, and All American Telephone, they filed a motion to sever that part of the case from this part of the case, from the counterclaims, so that they could appeal these claims now. And there is a threshold basis on which this court can affirm the trial court's ruling as to the tortious interference and as to the fraud claim, and it does pertain to the affidavit of Mr. Nelson Thibodeau. Mr. Carroll mentioned that USLD has complained that All American Telephone has not identified by name the customers. That wasn't our complaint. Our complaint was that there is no evidence of any contracts, and that in a tortious interference with contracts case, there needs to be evidence of a contract. And in this case, the only evidence regarding a contract between All American Telephone and someone else is set forth in the affidavit of Mr. Thibodeau, and that affidavit doesn't actually attach any contracts, not even one. What it does instead is it includes the following sentence, quote, "At that time, AAT had contracts to provide long-distance services with over 1 million customers." We objected to this statement on foundation grounds, and Judge Cosby excluded that statement, and it was certainly not an abuse of discretion for Judge Cosby to do that, and as the court knows, that is the relevant standard. And counsel, All American Telephone has made no showing that there's no legitimate basis for the ruling. In fact, as the radio station versus Jennings and the other cases we've cited in our briefing hold, personal knowledge is satisfied by an affirmative showing in the affidavit of how the affiant became personally familiar with the facts so as to be able to testify. Mr. Thibodeau was the husband of a shareholder in this and was not did not provide any basis. His affidavit doesn't say that he negotiated or drafted, but doesn't even say he ever read any of these contracts. So it was not an abuse of discretion for Judge Cosby to exclude that evidence, and the tortious interference ruling can be affirmed on that and several other grounds, but on that ground alone. Same with the fraud claim. The only evidence of a misrepresentation by USLD also comes from the Thibodeau affidavit. In the following statement, USLD, by and through its attorneys and representatives, continue to assure us that AAT would continue to be serviced by USLD pending a reconciliation of AAT's account. Now, we don't believe that statement can serve as a basis for a fraud claim for reasons I'll get into later, but as a threshold matter, we objected to that on foundation grounds. There's no provision, there's no description in here of who said that, what specifically was said, how it was communicated, and it very easily could have been that Mr. Thibodeau just heard this from somebody, and he's just relating that in his affidavit with no showing of foundation. Again, Judge Cosby sustained objections to that.
Were appellants given an opportunity to amend the affidavits?
They didn't request an opportunity to amend.
Do they have to request it? Doesn't the trial court have to give an opportunity to amend if it's a defect of form?
Well, this we believe is a defect in it's not a defect in form. It's a defect in it's a failure to have personal knowledge to make these statements in the first place, because the trial court considered other evidence that Mr. Thibodeau's involvement in here was as a husband of a shareholder who then got involved after the fact, after this lawsuit had started between AAT and its shareholders. So we don't believe there was a way to fix that problem in contrast to a situation where somebody just doesn't use the right words in an affidavit and there's a technical defect. And here, it certainly wasn't an abuse of Judge Cosby's discretion to exclude that evidence.
Wait. Wasn't he the same Thibodeau who was indicted for slamming and cramming involving his operations of AAT?
Yes, and we're not saying that Mr. Thibodeau doesn't have a basis for saying some things in his affidavit concerning that part of it, which occurred later, which was his malicious prosecution, which we believe fails for other reasons. But as to this particular statement that was excluded, there wasn't foundation for it, and it wasn't an abuse for Judge Cosby to exclude that. As far as the I can go to the malicious prosecution and jump into that if that would be helpful. Because
no, I was just curious about his personal knowledge and operations of the company.
He doesn't have personal knowledge as to the operations of the company. What he does have personal knowledge of is the fact of his prosecution and you know, things like that. But that's a very different thing from having personal knowledge of AAT's operations. And on the tortious, I'd like to jump to the malicious prosecution, and if I have time, I'll come back to the tortious interference and fraud. Malicious prosecution, of course, requires proof of an absence of probable cause for the criminal proceedings, and as the Texas Supreme Court held in the Ritchie case, there's an initial presumption of probable cause. And to overcome that presumption, Thibodeau and Nowick were required to produce evidence showing an absence of probable cause for the criminal prosecution. They didn't do so. They didn't provide evidence to overcome that there was an absence of probable cause, and their claim fails for that reason alone. In fact, although USLD is not required to do so, the actual record includes evidence that there was probable cause. Mr. Geary, who I mentioned earlier, the company's president, and Mr. Thompson, a manager of All American Telephone, they pled guilty to illegally obtaining customers. And the FCC fined All American Telephone $920,000 for violations it described as particularly egregious. And so USLD doesn't have to prove that there was probable cause, but that is the evidence. And that the claim that there was a failure, we heard it today, to disclose an exculpatory document, the agreement between Hold and USLD, that claim goes to other elements of malicious prosecution, but as the Ritchie Court made clear, not to probable cause. So Judge Cosby's ruling should be sustained on that basis alone. Moving to another element, which is but-for causation, as counsel said that it doesn't matter that USLD did not file the complaint that initiated the proceeding. Actually, it does matter quite a bit. As this court stated in Dangerfield and echoing the Browning-Ferris case and the King and Graham case, this court stated, a person cannot procure a criminal prosecution when the decision whether to prosecute is left to the discretion of another person, a law enforcement official, or the grand jury. And here, unlike the cases that have been cited, this is a situation where there was already a federal grand jury investigation, and USLD cooperated in that. This is not a situation like Ritchie or some of the other cases where the instrument that is essentially the charging instrument is something that was filed by the by the civil party who's being accused of malicious prosecution. And as counsel stated correctly, that if there were proof that USLD provided information that it knew was false, that even though this is a discretionary situation, you still could have it's an exception to the causation element. Well, there's no proof of that. USLD provided a second amended petition alleging it was owed over $2 million, and it did say that it portrayed itself as a victim and being out the $2 million. But that statement isn't false. In fact, summary judgment was ultimately granted for USLD on that issue, and there's no evidence that USLD believed it to be false. And Mr. Carroll also said that there was this supposedly exculpatory document, the hold agreement with USLD. There's nothing about that in any way proves that USLD had USLD had control over the customers. In the briefing and here today, we've heard that over and over again. USLD had control over these customers. There's no evidence of that. That's just something that's been repeated over and over and over in the briefing. The hold agreement.
If they're having a contract to receive payment from the customers, how do they not have some control?
If Hold has an agreement?
USLD has a contract with Hold, correct?
Only in the sense of what to do with these call records after the dispute arose. USLD had a contract with a company, a call rating company named Multimedia, and USLD provided long-distance services to Multimedia in exchange for payment. And then after this litigation arose, there was a settlement agreement signed by the appellants here in which All American Telephone assumed that agreement and assumed all the responsibilities under that agreement to pay USLD. USLD was not paid despite being there was past due on its for over $1 million for over 60 days past due at the time. USLD then was approached by Hold, and Hold said, we have a filed security interest in this case, and we have an interest in all of the, and that's it, first supplemental clerk's record, volume 1 on page 129. We have a security agreement in the customer base. We have a security agreement in the general intangibles and all the books and records. And USLD was told, you need to provide these call records to us because we are indisputably the billing, the factor for All American Telephone. And so USLD did that. It provided those records to Hold, but it did so under this agreement under which USLD it didn't even have any chance to receive any money. The money would go to Hold, the indisputable billing agent, and then monies over and above that amount at best could be deposited into the registry of the court. And so nothing about that agreement, as we've described in our motion, that agreement supports us and helps us, USLD, and it's defeating these counterclaims. It doesn't in any way show we had control over the customers. It said it would be Hold that would have control, but not USLD. And there's no, we've repeatedly challenged the appellants on this. We've no case under any theory finding there's liability in these types of circumstances where somebody's caught in the middle and does, frankly, the right thing and says, okay, fine, you can have the records, but we have a big claim that we think we're owed this $2 million, but we'll still comply with the security interest, and the money can go into the registry of the court, and then we'll take our shot there. We didn't control any money, and there's no evidence to the contrary on any of that. I'm going to end up having to rely on the briefing for the other points on our fraud. We don't think that the statement at issue is specific enough at all to support a fraud claim. At best, it would be a promise of future performance with no evidence of intention not to perform. On the tortious interference, in addition to the fact there's no contract, there's no evidence that USLD did any act of interference because of this. We didn't control the customers, despite how many times appellants have said that. We didn't act in a willful way, an intentional way. There's no evidence of any of that. What there's evidence of is that despite the fact we were indisputably owed the $2 million, by All American Telephone. We did the right thing and actually didn't try to take control of the money and the customers, and we complied with the filed security interest, had the money deposited into the registry of the court, and today we're out the $2 million still. All American Telephone declared bankruptcy, and we're unlikely to see anything at all. So we'd ask that this court affirm Judge Cosby's rulings for the reasons that we described in our briefing and today. I'm out of time. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Bolt. Mr. Carroll, rebuttal.
Thank you, Justice Livingston. Let me start with, I believe, Justice Gardner asked the question, the summary judgment and where it is. It's not a final judgment, Your Honor. There is no final judgment in that case at all, and I assure you we'll be appealing that if it ever gets around to becoming a final judgment. So they haven't proved anything as a matter of law, and they certainly haven't proved it in this proceeding that was severed that they were ever owed any kind of money at all. But the one thing that Mr. Bolt didn't address, and I want to call to the court's attention, is the testimony of their president, Mr. Wagner, president of USLD, whose deposition was taken. It's at the record, second supplement at 895. Question, do you remember AT ever having been a customer of USLD? Answer, no. Do you think All American Telephone owes USLD any money? My belief is Multimedia owes U.S. Long Distance. The importance of that is on the probable cause issue, because under Ritchie, probable cause is whether the party who makes representations to the prosecution believes or has reason to know what they're telling the prosecution is false. And here, Mr. Torres's affidavit and the second amended petition that they gave the prosecution is false if their own witness is telling the truth. Second, the hold agreement that wasn't disclosed to the prosecution falls clearly within the probable cause requirement, because what you can't do is you can't give the government some information, even if it's true, and withhold exculpatory information and say, King's X, you guys have discretion to indict or not indict. That doesn't fly under Texas law. It doesn't under this court's decision in Dangerfield. In Dangerfield, this court specifically said that a person reporting criminal conduct may nevertheless be considered to have procured the proceedings if he provides information that he knows is false. It is our position that we have raised a fact issue as to whether the information provided was false and whether that was a lack of probable cause for procuring the indictment.
Sir?
Yes, Justice Walker.
One of the first things we have to do when we address a case like this is determine exactly what the summary judgment evidence is. And so could you just briefly address, should the summary judgment evidence include the stricken portions, or is that irrelevant and unnecessary, and you believe that the remaining summary judgment evidence is sufficient to support your position?
I think the remaining summary judgment evidence on the malicious prosecution is clearly sufficient to support the position in this case. I do not think they're even challenging that issue. I think they're only challenging it with respect to the tortious interference and contract claims. I'll be brief. I believe Judge Cosby's rulings with respect to those were incorrect, because the testimony that there were the contracts is clear and sufficient. There is no requirement that there be any easy way to controvert it, which is what they argued to Judge Cosby. I think it was an abuse of discretion for Judge Cosby to sustain those particular objections to that affidavit evidence. But, Justice Walker, there is additional evidence besides that. If the court will look, and I believe it is the record, I believe it's a second supplement, 919 to 924, all of the evidence that was submitted in opposition to the Quest summary judgment motions and all the other summary judgment motions was submitted in opposition to this summary judgment motion. So it's not just Mr. Thibodeau's affidavit. All of that other evidence is incorporated by those two pleadings in response to this malicious prosecution summary judgment motion. On that basis, Your Honor, we request that the court reverse this matter and remand it for trial before a Tarrant County jury and give these gentlemen an opportunity to vindicate themselves. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll, Mr. Bolt, Mr. Williams. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. Your case is submitted. That concludes our submissions for today. If the clerk will now adjourn court.